Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the PHMSA Gas Transmission NPRM webinar. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ellen Mayberry. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'd like to welcome everyone to our webinar on the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking for Gas Transmission. My name is Alan Mayberry. I'm the Acting Associate Administrator for Pipeline Safety here at PHMSA. I'd like to take a brief moment to turn it over to John. We have a couple of technical issues we're working, and John wanted to highlight those up front.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Gale. I'm the Director of Standards and Rulemaking in the Office of Pipeline Safety. Some of you, I understand, are not being allowed into the room that lets you view the presentation. We have posted a copy of the exact presentation we're going to go through on the PHMSA public meeting page. So if you can access that public meeting page, you will see the presentation. We're currently working on trying to expand the number of folks we can allow into the Adobe Connect room just so you can see the page, but in lieu of that, you can actually go to the Primus meeting page, pull up the presentation, where that's basically where you registered, and you'll see at the very bottom the exact presentation that we're going to use today. We're going to give you a few introductory remarks, and while we're doing that, should give you time to pull up that presentation. Back to Alan.
All right. Yeah, thanks, John. We're coming to you today from PHMSA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and just wanted to say up front just briefly that we're holding these briefings to really raise the level of awareness and understanding of the proposed rule that we put out. And we've heard a number of comments over the length of it. Yes, it's quite a comprehensive rule, and in fact, it's probably the most comprehensive rule since integrity management and the inception of pipeline safety regulations back in 1970. But input from our stakeholders has always been very important, and we're always looking for ways to really leverage that, from all of our stakeholders, from the public, industry, the states, and then other government partners. So input on this rule is very important to us so that you'll be better informed to issue comments to us. And we'll be giving you instructions, if you don't already know, on how to submit comments to the docket on this rule. As a reminder, the comment period closes on July 7th, 2016. And without further ado, I think I'll turn it back over to John Gale, who will run the meeting today and start the briefing. Thank you very much for your participation. We had to go back and add lines, conference lines, because I think we're at over 750 who had signed up. So we really appreciate the interest from everyone on this and look forward to hearing robust comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Just to go over things again, the logistics, we have about a 40 to 45-minute presentation for you. We will then follow that up with about a 30-minute or so time for question and answers, which will take us up right up to the 3 o'clock time. We'll take our last question about 2:55 or so, so we can wrap this meeting up around 3 o'clock. Also, for those folks who are unable to attend today, and if you want to get the word out, we will actually are recording today's presentation, and we'll be posting a copy of the presentation on our public website. This initiative and this webinar is just one in many steps that we're trying to take to improve our stakeholder outreach when it comes to understanding our regulatory process, and then understanding better the regulations that we are actively involved with. We are also very interested in hearing from the public, hearing from all of our stakeholders on other initiatives that we can take and other methods that we can take on to improve that process. So if you have feedback you'd like to give us later, we're all ears, and we hope to improve that process moving forward. With that said, there's a couple points I'd like to make with regard to this rule. This rulemaking is a very large undertaking. It deals with some very significant mandates. This rule deals with mandates dealing with from things like the grandfather clause and elimination of that grandfather clause, to dealing with those pipelines that have inadequate records and mandates and recommendations regarding that. So if you're not in agreement with what we're trying to propose here, please also in your public comments that you provide to us by July 7th, please provide us alternative approaches on how to deal with those recommendations. We still have a requirement to move forward on these mandates, and we need to do that as quickly as possible. So though you may disagree with what we have proposed today or proposed back in April, please provide us insight. Please provide us thoughts on how we can comply with those mandates. And with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Israni, our senior technical advisor.
Good afternoon, all. I'm Mike Israni. The purpose of today's presentation is to give you an overview and clarify certain features of the proposed rule. Steve and I will do our best to answer your questions after the presentation. So this rulemaking makes critical updates to improve safety for gas transmission and gas gathering lines. It does not apply to distribution lines. It also addresses lessons learned from the recent incidents with significant consequences and implements four congressional mandates from 2011 Pipeline Safety Act, six NTSB recommendations, and one GAO recommendation.
Next slide.
Okay, so advance notice of proposed rulemaking was published on August 25th, 2011. And that happened right after the major incidents on San Bruno case, which was September 2010, and Marshall, Michigan, by hazardous liquids in July 2010. And in this NPRM, PHMSA had sought comments on 15 topics, almost 122 questions. So this proposal, it covers 16 topic areas, and 13 of those were in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. And a couple of those topics, like valves and leak detection, et cetera, underground storage, those will be handled by a separate rulemaking. And out of these 16 topics, as you can see in the slides, our proposal requires assessment for non-high consequence areas. It strengthens repair requirements for high consequence areas and non-high consequence areas, strengthens requirements for assessment methods that we use. We have added certain reference standards, which I'm going to cover in detail, which provide a lot more information on how assessments can be applied more efficiently. It also clarifies data on collection, integration and validation of the pipeline. It strengthens corrosion control requirements. It also adds requirements for selected preventive and mitigative measures in high consequence areas with a particular attention to internal corrosion and external corrosion. This proposal also covers management of change. Management of change was in the high consequence areas required, but now it will apply to both high consequence areas and the moderate consequence areas. Proposal also requires pipeline inspection following the extreme events, meaning, you know, after storms, flooding, earthquakes, etc. You know, the quick inspection within certain time frame certainly helps and prevents a lot more consequences. Also includes 6 months grace period after 7 years of this assessment, reporting requirements for MAOP exceedance, and also addresses seismicity, which was part of the Act requirement. It also adds certain safety features on launchers and receivers, and we are covering gathering lines, reporting on all, and some regulatory requirements on certain gathering lines. And last, and one of the most important one being the integrity verification process for those lines which are falling under grandfather clause or those who have inadequate records. I want to make clear that this one does not apply to distribution lines. In this proposal, we have various definitions in, including distribution center, gas processing plants, and gas treatment facilities. Those were added for clarification purposes, not to extend requirements. Now, going into details of these proposals.
Just real quick, for those of you who have just joined us recently, we are having some difficulty with our Adobe Connect connection, so you can view the presentation. If you are unable to view the presentation, you can go to the PHMSA meeting page, where that's the meeting page where you registered for the meeting. And at the very bottom of the page is a link to the presentation, and you can follow the presentation from there. Thank you.
Okay. Starting with the assessment for non-high consequence areas, you know, accidents do happen in non-high consequence areas. In fact, we had 2000, we had the Carlsbad, New Mexico accident. Then 2007, there was in Delhi, Louisiana, right by I-20. And also in 2012, Sissonville, West Virginia incident that happened. All of those non-high consequence areas incidents and our own investigation and lessons learned, we are requiring an assessment outside of high consequence areas. So this high consequence areas, we are proposing to all class 3 and 4 locations and newly modified moderate consequence areas, which are piggable, the lines which can have internal inspection devices that can pass. And these assessments are within 15 years and subsequent assessments every 20 years. Thanks. Moderate consequence areas are the areas with a potential impact circle containing 5 or more buildings intended for human occupancy or an occupied site where 5 or more persons who are prevalent or who happen to be there 50 days in 12-month period. We are also including in the moderate consequence areas interstate highways and 4-lane roads, which was required by NTSB's recommendation. Next slide. Now, with the assessments, we obviously going to have repair criteria also in the non-high consequence areas, and we are also revising some of the repair criteria, which is existing in the high consequence areas. We have similar repair conditions, which are immediate and 1-year conditions for both high consequence areas and non-high consequence areas, except for the time frame. Outside of high consequence areas, we require immediate and 2-year period, and in the high consequence area, we have immediate and 1-year conditions. And then we have some monitored conditions. And one of the reasons for making these changes in the high consequence areas for repairs is because of the lessons we have learned from the last 12 years on the pipeline. And also, as I said, that, you know, we believe that this lacked certain important conditions of the pipeline. For example, corrosion in the pipeline to 80% metal loss wasn't there included before, or general corrosion over 50%, et cetera. One of the features we have added also for 1-year condition is when the failure pressure ratio is dropped below 1.25 times MAOP, then operators have 1 year to fix that. And other conditions you can see in the rulemaking. Next slide. Strengthening requirements for selection and use of assessment methods. We have introduced certain standards. We reference certain standards like NACE standards, API, and ASNET standards, mainly on the ILI tools. NACE standards we also have for internal corrosion direct assessment and also for stress corrosion cracking direct assessment. The tool tolerance is most important for detecting the anomalies, and this rule, this proposal emphasizes operators to consider that. Also, some of the standards that we have referenced here, they refer to qualification of the operators who are reading those results and making determination. We are also adding certain assessment methods like guided way ultrasonic testing and in situ direct examination. As I mentioned, that collecting, integrating, and validation of data is the most important part. Operators are collecting information, but they are not validating their data, or they are not integrating it adequately. Mainly, they have to kind of consider not only the data across the pipeline, but they have to also see what are the anomalies, which are not necessarily high-level anomalies, to consider those into their formula and their evaluation. Also, interactive threats, et cetera, there to consider. Next slide. We noticed over the years that the risk models used by operators are very simple indexing type models. Many of them, not all of you, have been using, and that those risk models may not give you accurate results for analyzing anomalies. So some more specificity is given to the nature and application of risk models that you choose, meaning we have required that operators' risk models to include interacting threats. These are like if you have corrosion and you have a fault line crossing in the same area, you'll have a double effect or much more than double effect. So your risk models need to consider all of that. Also, that operators have to look at their past integrity management results and consider that into the risk formulas in evaluation and in the risk models. Next. As I mentioned, that integrity management rule was issued almost 10 years ago, so operators should have enough information on what results they got from their previous risk assessments. Those are to be included, and we have also improved on the preventive mitigative measures, which are currently required for the high consequence areas only. We have specified certain preventive mitigative measures that operators have to consider and not just ignore all of those which previously were in the appendix. Strengthening the corrosion control requirements, as I say, that current code does not have adequate corrosion control requirements. It simply says that continuing surveys require, there are no specific requirements there. We have emphasized in this proposal internal and external corrosions. We have also included, as I said, in high consequence area, preventive mitigative measures, but emphasis on the internal and external corrosion. And our emphasis here is on the disbonded coatings and corrosion, where along the seams and the longitudinal welded corrosion that we have noticed in the recent incidents. Also, there are some time frames given to how often operators have to do the coating survey and the close interval surveys in this rulemaking. Next. I already covered the preventive mitigative measures, more emphasis given on internal and external corrosions. And as I mentioned, that was mainly because of the, we have noticed even in the new construction, all on the existing lines, the coating on the pipeline, disbonded coating and the longitudinal wells and cracking. Next one. Management of change, you know, for the high consequence areas, we had the management of change already in the ASME B31-8S document, but we have emphasized this more by codifying it. We have put that in the regulation. We want to know the reasons for this change and operators to have, you know, to also, you know, who authorized the changes, et cetera. This way we'll ensure that any change that takes place in pipeline, it flows through the entire corporate structure and everybody's aware of it. This is a good example of San Bruno case where what happened on the field, headquarters were not aware of it. So that we're trying to prevent such incidents. Next. After Yellowstone River incident from ExxonMobil's pipeline. We have introduced this requirement for inspection following extreme events, and those extreme events can be flooding, storms, earthquakes, landslides, etc. We have certain time frame, 72 hours, for operators to have inspection done in these areas. You know, when we say inspections, we mean visual plus ILI or whatever is required. Obviously, we require visual inspection within 72 hours, and others, you know, can follow up beyond 72 hours, but only when operators and equipment can safely be approached after the event. Next. 6 months grace period was required. This gives operators some opportunity to evaluate their system after 7 years of assessment, so they can figure out when the next assessment can be established.
Next.
MAOP exceedance, you know, the operator's maximum operating pressure can exceed during the shutdowns or changes in the pressure, and more frequently it happens, more chances of pipeline failure can occur. We want reporting of that because this can directly relate to safety-related condition. We want operators to report that.
Next.
Seismicity was another factor which was required in the Act to be introduced in the data as well as in our assessment of the pipeline. You know, the different pipelines which fall in different seismic zones, they have to consider that into their risk analysis and risk models.
Next.
Adding the safety features on launchers and receivers, you know, there have been some incidents when operators have had the crew try to open up to remove the launchers, to remove the smart peg, if they do not know the pressure is totally released from the system. So this proposal requires operators to have some pressure gauge to indicate, as well as some safety valve to release the pressure from the lines.
Next.
Expanding requirements on onshore gas gathering lines. Now, since 2007, we have noticed the gas production has grown by 30%, and the new gas production introduced a lot more new gathering lines and large diameter gathering lines with high pressures, which are unregulated. So this proposal is trying to attempt to collect data on those lines. We are really trying to get into the shale gas area. We want to find out what those pipelines are, what they are, from the annual reports and incident reports. We'll gather more knowledge on what regulation feature we can apply to those lines. So that's one thing. And secondly, we are also introducing certain category of gathering lines, which are in class one location, which are larger diameter, more than 8 inches, which will have requirements not only for reporting, but there are certain requirements like corrosion, damage prevention, surveillance, markers, emergency response. All of the requirements are what currently apply to regulated gathering lines. We believe that these changes will add additional 68,000 to 70,000 miles of gathering lines. Currently, we regulate about 11,000 pipelines. And also, we are improving on the API RP 80 definition. We are eliminating that reference standard because there was a lot of ambiguity on where the gathering line begins and where it ends. We have specified those areas. Some other lines, some other paragraphs we have used from the API RP 80, but we have improved on this, especially when multiple production facilities have the gathering lines coming and joining. So we think that will clarify on where it begins and where it ends. And next, Steve Nanny will pick up the integrity verification process.
Good afternoon. I hope everyone can hear me. My name is Steve Nanny, and I'm on slide 21. On the slides that I have, and it's 16 Integrity Verification Process, IVP. And what I'll be talking about today will be the statutory mandates and the NTSB recommendation. Also on records, as you probably have seen going through the notice and Appendix A, we have put together a table with the records retention schedule so that it's easier for everyone to find. Material documentation, that's Section 192.607, that we have material documentation. And you know, if you just go back and look at when Integrity Management first came out, FIMSA incorporated into Subpart O a lot of sections of ASMEB 318S. And if you look at Table 1 in B318S, it has the attributes that you need in a integrity management program. Pipe wall thickness, diameter, seam type and joint factor, manufacturer, manufacturing date, material properties, equipment properties. And what we've tried to do on the material documentation is to follow, what's in B318S and also presently what's in the code in the series around 192, 106, 109, 192, 111. But in those sections, it says that the operator has to destructively test. So we tried to give options of some non-destructive test methods there. And then the MAOP determination section is in 192.624, and we tried to give several options there. And I'll go through those as we talk through it. Going to page 22, what's led us to do this, as Mike, John, and Alan earlier had said, is FIMSA doesn't sit around and try to come up with new regulations every day. That's not what we try to do when we go to work every day. But anyway, the regulations, the congressional mandates, the NTSB recommendations that we've got is what's driving it from incidents. First of all, the Pipeline Safety Act of 2011 mandated testing regulations for all gas transmission pipe, Class 3, 4, and all HCAs that's not previously been tested. But you can use an ILI program as an alternative equivalent means. Also, we from NTSB P11-14, we did get a recommendation from them to delete the grandfather clause. And that recommendation recommended all grandfathered pipe to be pressure tested, including with a spike test. Then we've got NTSB P-11-15, seam stability, and that recommends a pressure test to at least 1.25 times MAOP before treating the manufacturing and construction defects as stable. And then last is NTSB P-11-17, on piggable lines that recommends configuring all lines to accommodate smart pigs with the priority given to older lines. Slide 23. In looking at that, we went back and just to lay out what we covered in the rulemaking was the IVP was based upon four principles. Since we had the congressional mandate for high consequence areas, class 3 and 4 areas, and also we added moderate consequence areas is where there's five or more people in the PIR area. Then NTSB came back to us and wanted us to add interstate highways and four-lane roads, and you'll see that as part of the definition of moderate consequence area. Item 2 we looked at is screen segments for categories of concern. In other words, the grandfathered segments where the records do not exist or they're incomplete. And then from that, to come up with what would be a proper or adequate material and a documentation of that material program. And then last was to perform assessments to establish the MAOP. And the assessments is probably the hardest part of it because you've got transmission lines of various sizes, various pressures, various lengths, things like that. Going to slide 24, our first principle, to just give you an idea of when we did the RIA, looking at the cost-benefit, presently high-consequence areas are about 20,000 miles. Class 3 and 4 in non-HCA, when we went through looking at what we thought would be applicable, was about 18,000 miles. And then the Class 1 and 2 MCA-type areas, the piggable we looked at would be approximately 13,000 miles, non-piggable about 8,600 miles. Going to slide 25. As far as screening the categories of concern, what we looked at is on the grandfathered pipe, of course, was HCAs, Class 3 and 4 locations, and piggable MCA pipelines. And then we also looked at pipelines that had a lack of material records and pressure test records in the HCAs, Class 3 and 4 locations. And then also we looked at pipelines where in these areas, the Class 3, 4, HCAs, and piggable lines, where there was a history of failures attributable to manufacturing and construction defects. Going to slide 26. As far as knowing and documenting the pipe material, we already knew that in the code, as I'd stated earlier, there was destructive test methodology spelled out in 192.106 and several sections after it, and also in one of the appendix to the code. And we realize, as far as doing that, of cutting out pipe, and I think every 10 or so joints, what it had in there was quite severe and not doable. So we tried to come up with an alternative methodology that we thought would be get us the same result without cutting out pipe. Of course, you could always go and cut out pipe and test the pipe samples. Of course, that's a code-approved process. But we also wrote up to do in-situ non-destructive testing. In other words, you'd have to have validated procedures. You'd have to validate the non-destructive test procedures on pipe of the same grade, et cetera, and also a way of testing to make sure that the chemistry of the pipe was in the category that you were looking for. Now on that, whether we got too many properties there that need to be tested, you know, that's something, if you give us comments, we would gladly look at. Also, going through a field verification of the code stamp for components. In other words, we wanted the operator to set up a procedure of verifying that the valves, flanges, and fabrications that were in the line met the MAOP, and on future ones on new lines that was verified and kept up with. Going to slide 27. Then we looked at methods to establish the MAOP. And what we wanted to do is, of several methods, is to give the operator the flexibility. And that is, of course, you could do a pressure test, and you may need a spike test depending upon if you've got manufacturing and construction type issues, as is spelled out in 192.624. You could do a pressure reduction, an engineering critical assessment using ILI. You could replace the pipeline. We also have in there where you've got a low PIR or an 8-inch or less diameter pipeline with low pressure, some methodology there. And, of course, you can always come to us for other technology. So that's the type methods we tried to lay out. Going to slide 28. Going a little deeper into 624. Is first the pressure test method would be a 1.25 or a class location type test factor times MAOP. Again, if you had a pipe that had issues, whether it was failures, legacy pipe, stress corrosion cracking, selective seam weld cracking, to do a spike test. And then you'd need to, if you did have cracking or any issues that would have a life be time dependent, then of course you would need to estimate the remaining life. Method two, again, was a pressure reduction. You could reduce your pressure based upon 1.25, and then if it did have a time-dependent defects, to estimate the remaining life. Going to slide 29, the next item there under 624C on MAOP determination would be an engineering critical assessment. And again, we laid out a methodology as far as using it, as far as with some specific technical and material documentation where you've got issues there to analyze the crack, the metal loss, or if it's interacting defects that are remaining in the pipe, and come up with a proper a pressure failure ratio. And then the MAOP to be established based upon the applicable factor in 192.619 or 192.620. Slide 30, MAOP determination, again, other methods in there. Method four is pipe replacement. Method five, a small PIR would be a pipe 8 inches and smaller and has a PIR of 150 feet or less. And then an alternative approach that you could send to PHMSA for no objection. Slide 31, compliance deadlines for 192.624 would be to develop a plan in the first year, and then 50% of the mileage to be assessed by the end of year 8, and then 100% by the end of year 15. And we also have in it if there are environmental or operational constraints, you can petition the associate administrator for an additional one-year extension. And then as far as reassessments that are in the in this would be a maximum 20-year interval as far as any reassessments. Slide 32, if there's any pipe that there's a cracking where you need to look at a crack growth analysis, the failure stress of it, and if you do have any cyclic fatigue, I realize gas pipelines are not like liquids as far as that. We did have in that you need to look at pipes susceptible to cracks or crack-like defects to do a fatigue analysis of those techniques, to analyze the microstructure on whether it's ductile, brittle, or both in doing that. And then a second reevaluation before 50% of the remaining life has expired. And then the results to be confirmed by an independent third-party expert. It's what I believe we've got in there. Going to the next slide, on slide 33, if you look at the spike test in 192.506, I realize when you go around, everybody has a little different definition of a spike test. We decided that we needed to get it out, get comments, and have the discussion on what a proper spike test should be. And again, it would apply to pipelines that are required to be assessed that have a hoop stress of 30% SMICE and have had integrity threats that cannot otherwise be addressed by ILI, or they have their MAOP established in accordance with Method 1 pressure test in 624, and the pipe has legacy pipe or segments that have had incidents involving cracks, manufacturing, or installation related. And we defined the spike as being for the cracks to be a minimum of 1.5 times MAOP or 105% of SMICE, either or, and then a spike duration of 30 minutes and a total test duration of 8 hours. I realize that, I've seen over the years spike tests defined as anywhere from 1.25 to 110% of SMICE. And I realize based upon the type cracking, everything I've seen is the 105 to 110% is what you see in a lot of the technical papers. FEMSA realizes that we have to be open as far as listening of other methodology, and again, that's why we're having this discussion today and why we're asking for comments. And the same thing on the spike duration. If you look at the literature, it's anywhere from a few minutes, such as 10, up to an hour. We put 30 minutes here, which we thought was reasonable. And we haven't seen anything to date that would make us think that it's not. And then a total test duration, like the code says, at a reduced pressure for 8 hours. That's it as far as going through the integrity verification. Slide 34, I think, turns it back over to John.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you, Mike. Again, we apologize for our technical difficulties. Sometimes your IT systems throw you for a curveball, but luckily we had a copy of the presentation up and available for you to review, and hopefully if you had a hiccup, it was a small one at that to follow through on the presentation. At this point in time, we'd like to take some questions from the participants. We can take questions, like I said, up to about 2 hours and 55 minutes, 2:55. And also what we can do is answer questions that clarify the proposal. So please limit your questions to that. If we're unable to answer the questions, we'll try to get back to you, or you can just bring your issue up in the comments you provide to the docket. As a reminder, the comment period ends on July 7th, and we're looking forward to reading your comments. And with that, I'll turn it over to Terry, our moderator, who will give instructions on how to submit comments through the teleconference. Terry?
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star then zero on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing those numbers. Once again, it's star zero if you would like to ask a question. Once again, it's star zero if you would like to ask a question. We'll go to the line of Heidi Keller. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Heidi Keller with API. Again, thank you, FEMSA, for holding this webinar on obviously very important rule. We do have a couple of questions. In sections 191.23 and 191.25, we're wondering if you could please clarify if the reporting of MAOP exceedance is intended for unregulated gathering. And if so, could you please point us to where this might be in the regulatory impact analysis? Thank you.
Yeah, so this applies only to the gas transmission line, as is clearly indicated in that proposal. The for transmission line, each exceedance of the MAOP should be reported. And what was the second part of your question?
The cost benefit considerations, if it was included in gas gathering. We receive very few safety related condition reports annually as it is. Yeah. We do not anticipate to receive very many additional if they would be required on the gathering. So it wasn't considered.
Okay. Thank you. Question in regards to MAOP. Do the pipeline materials and MAOP verification requirements in 192.607 192.619E and 192.624 also apply to regulated regulated gathering? And if so, again, could you tell us where this would be in the REIA? Thank you.
But your question is whether it would be in the REIA in our cost benefit analysis.
Well, and also if the MAOP verification requirements in 607, 619E, and 624 apply to regulated gathering, we would requesting that clarification.
Yeah, Steve, go ahead on this.
Well, if you look at 607A, it states gas transmission pipelines. In 607A. What was the next section that you asked?
We're also curious about 619E and 620.
619E.
Type A, Area 1, is required to follow the transition. So that is the whole gathering into that.
Earlier, Steve pointed out that maximum allowable operating pressure requirements that we have here do apply to only transmission lines and not to gathering lines. Gathering lines do have requirements already in place under 619. Those have not been changed.
Okay, so clarify, 619E does not apply to regulated gathering.
Steve, you have any say on that?
I agree. I'm looking at it. 619E is for a transmission.
Okay.
Not regulated gathering.
Okay. And 624?
624, by definition, says that even the heading says that it's only for gas transmission lines.
Okay. I'll keep going. Can you please clarify that you did not intend to make Type A, Area 2, and Type B gathering lines more stringent than Type A, Area 1 lines?
That is correct. Yeah, we wanted same requirements that were applying previously to, Type A, Type B, class one. Let me see. Type A original lines, which were there, meaning the class 2, 3, and 4 lines. Yeah. So requirements which are for Type A, class 1, 8 inches or greater, are corrosion damage prevention, surveillance markers, and emergency plan. Those are similar to what was originally required for Type B, class 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we'll go to the line of Mike Purcell. Please go ahead.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, in the Type A gathering line rule for Class 1, where did the 8 inches come from, just out of curiosity?
Well, originally we started with including all the gathering lines on this, and then after studying that, we were really exceeding our cost-benefit numbers really high, and also it included quite a lot of issues with the lines which were much smaller, and we feel the impact of those lines will be minimal. So let's attack the larger diameter pipelines. So that's where we picked up 8 inches or larger. You know, we are collecting data on the smaller diameter lines anyway. So as we learn there are more incidents, we'll pick up those lines. Currently, requirements apply only to lines which are larger than 8 inches.
I was looking at, you know, we're in Ohio. We have a lot of higher pressure lines here. And for the annual reporting, it'd been nice to have even the class one for all sizes, even 4-inch, just as a comment.
Yeah, the for reporting requirements, they apply to all the lines, whether they're regulated or unregulated, all classes, for reporting only.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, sorry if I had not mentioned that earlier. We try to pick up all the gathering lines currently which are regulated or those are unregulated. Reporting requirements required for all of them, and we believe that will cover close to 280,000 plus miles of pipeline. But regulated lines which have these fewer requirements, for corrosion damage prevention, those are about 68,000 miles of pipeline.
And Mr. Purcell, did you have additional questions?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. And next we'll go to line of Paul Jarosky. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Paul Jarosky. I'm in northeastern Ohio. And, you know, in my mind, safety is focused on prevention, and I really appreciate that PHMSA is proactive and forward-looking and, you know, trying to take the appropriate steps to prevent, you know, accidents and incidents. However, I think you're missing, you know, you spend a lot of time talking about HCAs, but I think you're missing one of the fundamental issues in play here, and that's under 49 CFR 195.210. Now, you can build these gigantic high-pressure pipelines within 50 feet of a residence or a church or a school or gathering place. What is PHMSA planning on doing on addressing the issue of creating more high-consequence areas by allowing pipelines to be built within such close proximity to residences? And why isn't it addressed in this rulemaking round?
Well, we, you know, our current high consequence areas, you know, they cover the pipeline within the impact circle, 20 or more buildings, and we have in this rulemaking what we call moderate consequence areas, where we include 5 or more buildings within the impact circle. And we also included highways and, you know, 4-lane roads. Including all the way to even one single building was a little beyond the scope at the moment because we believe that to achieve best results with the economic analysis, we, you know, brought it down to 5 buildings or 5 structures within the circle, impact circle.
Mike, could I just add one thing?
Sure, go ahead.
One thing that you need to realize, PHMSA does not have siting authority. In other words, PHMSA does not have any input as far as where the pipeline is routed. That's other regulatory authorities. So we can't, in our regulation on the gas side, tell the operator where to where to route the pipeline. The section that you cited, part 195.210, is in the liquid code, and what we're talking about here today is gas. I mean, we understand your concern on pipelines being close to homes and residences, and that's why we've got the designation of high consequence area. That's why the operators are running inline inspection tools and doing the remediation required to make them safe. And we all understand your concern, everybody here on the phone for PHMSA, and, And I'm sure if the operators that are listening could say the same thing, they would. But thank you for the comment.
So who's going to do anything about appropriate safety setback standards for natural gas pipelines?
We do not have any plans to do that at the moment.
And who's responsible for it if it's not PHMSA?
It would be the permitting agency that actually gives the operator the permit as far as routing the pipeline. In most cases, for our gas transmission, would be the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Acronym would be FERC.
Except they tell me that that's the responsibility of Department of Transportation and PHMSA. I seem to be getting sent around in a circle.
Okay. Well, I understand your concern, and we all do. That's why we have these additional repair criteria and everything. You're welcome. I can give you my name and phone number, your email address. If you'll email me later, you know, we can talk more offline if you would like.
Thank you. You want to give me your number now? Or
yes, I'll give it to you. Steve, Steve, dot Nanny, Nanney, at dot.gov. If you'll email me your name and phone number, we'll get back to you.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
And this is Mike Israni, and we also encourage you to put your comments in the docket so we can answer. Everybody can, know what authorities we have, what Bureau of Land Management has authority, because they determine also location of the pipeline.
Thank you.
And next we'll go to line of Tim Beeler. Please go ahead.
Yes, Tim Beeler out of Virginia. My question is in regards to the inspections following extreme events such as floods, earthquakes, hurricanes, et cetera. Will there be any guidance as to what constitutes an event, or would that be left to the operator? Example, earthquake, would you be looking at the size of the quake, the magnitude within a certain distance of an epicenter, or again, would that be left up to the operator to make that call?
This mic is Ronnie. A similar questions came up during the hazardous liquid rulemaking. We don't make that determination. So best we could come up with was so long as operator and the equipment can be safely accessed in that location, regardless of the hurricane, if it was very high frequency, category 3 or 5, hurricane, or it could be just a small storm, or it could be rainfall which caused flooding. We didn't want to restrict it to certain levels. We believe that, damage could occur from debris in the rivers at any event. So we expect operators to have at least a initial visual survey of those areas to see if there's any damage to the pipeline.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we'll go to line of Susan Olenchuk. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I have two questions, actually. The first question deals with Section 192.395F, which addresses internal corrosion preventive and mitigative measures. And the question is, how are internal corrosion P&M measures intended to be applied to those pipelines that have numerous short, non-contiguous HCAs on them?
Well, if you had the high consequence areas established in your lines before you noticed that they were not contiguous, they were all the different sections. So many operators, they use their best judgment whether to run the pig all the way through or they, have some temporary launchers and receivers, which I think would be probably more expensive than running the pig from one HCA segment to another HCA segment. So, if you're running your smart pigs from pumping one compressor station to the next compressor station, you have only few HCA segments in that, and you're covering a lot more mileage, and that's probably what is happening. Existing lines have that scenario, unless you're doing direct assessment or some other method. So it's the best judgment operators can use, you know, to use an ILI all the way through or try to run some other method.
Okay, so what about the required use of filter separators and gas monitoring equipment and using inhibitors of for corrosive gas?
Is your question whether those are how they are going to be assessed?
Yes. How does PHMSA anticipate that lines that have multiple HCAs, how does PHMSA anticipate that operators would comply with these individual requirements for a line with those characteristics?
Steve, you want to...
Yes, if you've got multiple HCAs, just like what Mike said, in a pipeline segment, in most cases, the operator is going to run inline inspection. As far as where you've got input going into the transmission line, and I don't have the section in front of me right at the moment, but there are requirements to do gas monitoring for corrosive gas. And based upon periodic, I think we've got it in twice a year to have a review of the results. And then if you do have something in the gas stream that's corrosive, then whether that's additional pigging, whether that's adding in filter separators at the point where you're receiving this gas, whether it's more treatment of the gas, whether it's putting in coupons to monitor what the effect is, we've got a number of different items spelled out. The majority of the gas transmission pipelines are going to receive gas that's going to be non-corrosive. There are going to be situations where there's upsets and things at the plants that are feeding where they may get some off-spec gas. And by having this monitoring, they will be able to catch it. And if they need to do additional pigging, inhibitor injections, those type things, then we do have requirements that they would have to do those additional measures.
And would they have to perform those additional measures at each individual HCA along the line?
Well, normally what it would be is if you've got a pigging program or inline inspection program, from segment to segment, it would go through all of those at the same, not at the same time, but let's say you've got one that's upstream and one's downstream. When you launch a pig, it would go through all those contiguous segments.
My second question is with respect to non-piggable lines. In particular, what is PHMSA's expectations for Class 3 lines and MCA lines that are not capable of accommodating an inline inspection tool?
Well, we are allowing all these methods which were previously allowed for high-consequence areas, meaning hydro-testing, smart pig, or direct assessment. So if the line is not piggable, you could use the other methods.
Okay. Thank you.
And next we'll go to the line of Michael Avanzi. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. My question pertains to the material documentation for flanges, valves, fabrications, those sorts of things. To what level of detail are you expecting operators to take this? Is there like a minimum size? I'm thinking about like meter stations and regulator stations that are tied to transmission lines. What level of detail for the material documentation is PHMSA expecting?
I'm sorry, I had my phone on mute, so... I think if you go look at 607, we've got a criteria that that I think it's 2-inch and greater that we have in there, 2-inch nominal diameter and greater, or material grades greater than X42. But then we also have appurtenances of any size that are directly installed on the pipeline and cannot be isolated from mainline pipeline pressures. As far as flanges, you know, if you look on a flange, it will have the ANSI, whether it's ANSI 300, 600, 900, that would be stamped on the flange, that type of information. So you should be able to get it from the flange. If it's a flange you're talking about, if it's a mainline valve or a valve of any sort, it should have the, again, the API grade or the pressure rating on it, unless for some reason it's been stripped off of it. And if there's other things on fabrications, normally a fabrication, you will have drawings that show the material properties of what it was made from and tested to, that should be able to document the maximum allowable operating pressure of that. If you have other instances that you think we need to cover, or at least in the preamble have some wording about, please send that to us as a comment, because we would like to get those kind of comments. If we need to change the wording or make it to where, like in your question, it's a little more clear.
On the stamping that's on your flanges and valves and whatnot, how do you expect us to document that for the future? Because once you sandblast those fittings and coat them, then in the future you probably won't be able to dig those up and read that information.
Well, I think the ANSI stamp on them is something you can see in the future. But on the new pipeline, I believe I would probably as-built it or keep the documentation that I get for it when I purchase it. Yeah, the easiest would be to keep that documentation when you purchase it and request it from the supplier.
So one more follow-up question on that. On existing pipelines, are you expecting us to go back and document all the flanges, valves, fabrications that are tied to existing transmission lines?
Well, it would be if you look at 192.607, where it says verification of pipeline material. This would be areas in Class 3 and 4 locations and high-consequence areas. So you got to understand, it's the areas where there's people around, and the answer is yes, we would expect if you do not have it that you would document it.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. And next we'll go to the line of Susan Ginsberg. Please go ahead.
This has to do with the regulatory impact analysis, and I feel like I'm in a bit of a catch-22 in that right now the RIA applies to the rules that would affect regulated gathering. But under some open rulemakings that might be in final form, by the time the final rule would be issued in this notice of proposed rulemaking, there are a lot of changes, like on operator qualifications, plastic piping, and my understanding is that the RIA incorporating that wouldn't come out until the final rule in this NOPR is issued. I'm just trying to understand how I can address the impact of those pending changes under the expanded definition of gathering that would take place in this proposed rulemaking.
I think the best thing to do is to submit that comment and outline the issues and the concerns you have with that.
Mm-hmm.
We've been made aware of that at a recent advisory committee, and we're taking a little very hard look at that and how that expansion or those changes in OQ would impact any changes associated with our change in the definition of regulated gathering. So we appreciate any kind of comment you could give us on that.
Thank you.
And next we'll go to the line of William Houston. Please go ahead.
Hi there. So I have a couple of general statements and maybe a question or two. So my first general statement is that, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, a lot seems to be dependent upon the definition that you're using for a potential impact radius. And for about the last, say, 3 years, I've been attempting to calibrate the formula that PHMSA is using, and it's codified in the law or in the regulations, which have the force of law. And it's really way off. I've really been able to gain documentation on 7 of the most the largest pipeline accidents, and the PIR prediction was way off in every case. So I'm a little concerned that in this present rulemaking, it looks like you don't have any intention to revise the PIR formula. Is that correct?
But that is correct. You know, when we established first time the PIR, it was based on 10 major incidents that had happened, and the actual impact circles were measured for NTSB report, and the formula that was derived by GRE or GTI research project by CC Technology of Canada, that was based on the actual incidents and footprints of those explosions. I don't know if they subsequently have modified those or not, but you know, we are not making any changes in that area here.
But we are changing the trigger that it requires assessing. Right? We're changing the trigger that requires assessing that is currently in roughly 20 homes within the PIR to 5. But if you have any comments that you believe are relevant to our discussion, especially on how PIRs are calculated, we'd be glad to look at those.
I'm going to file a formal comment with a lot of details that I've been looking at. My other comment has to do with just in general that for a layman to look at the PHMSA rules, I don't know if you've ever had anybody make a comment on this before, but in my opinion, they are extremely complicated and self-referential. You have to continuously go back and forth throughout the code because, you know, one definition is used as input to other definitions. For example, you know, class and high consequence area and PIR are all, I would say, PIR inputs into high consequence and class. You know, the class definition is only looking at 660 feet to either side of the pipeline. This is way too small. In other words, I really feel like some of these basic definitions that you're using to build off of are really not adequate looking at actual historical pipeline Hello?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so they're really inadequate. And then just the last comment that I have is that the other thing that disturbs me is we've already got, you know, the 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection of the law for all citizens. And what we already have is we've already have this general schema or framework of pipeline safety regulations that are based on population density, class 1, class 2, class 3, HCAs. And now, so you've got way too many different classes, and now you're introducing another one. You're introducing the moderate consequence area. This is going in the wrong direction, in my opinion. We need to be simplifying this, and I would say that if you live in, first of all, you need to fix the PIR and make that accurate. And in Westmoreland County, the recent accident that just happened, April 29th, the impact radius was 2,200 feet at least. We have no good sighting, the 2,200 feet, and the predicted PIR was 671 feet. That's a 3.3x error delta. That's huge. That's too big. So first we need to fix the PIR, and then the next thing we need to have a simple classification. If you live in the PIR, you live in a high consequence area, and all people, rural or cities, should have the same safety regulations given to them, afforded to them. I think James Baker, who's living in a hospital bed right now with burns over 75% of his body, he would ask for the same protection as somebody living in a city. Thank you.
Also, we'll appreciate that you put that comment in the docket.
I will. Thank you.
And once again, if you do have a question, you may press star 0, or if you have given your name to the operator, you may press star 1, and that'll put you in queue for your question. And we'll go to the line of Matt Norton. Please go ahead.
This is Matt Norton with Gas Processors Association. So I wanted to clarify or ask a clarifying question that I'm not sure that I heard answered earlier. The MAOP establishment and material verification is or is not intended to apply to the remaining unregulated Class 1 gathering?
No, it is not.
Just to add to that is the material documentation for areas outside of Class 3, 4, and high consequence areas would need to be in accordance with a 192, 106, 109, 107, 111. If you look at those, if you do not know the wall thickness, seam type, grade, it has a criteria in there to go by.
Class
3, 4, and high consequence areas.
Okay, and a follow-up question, and this relates to some earlier questions that were asked as well. There seems to be quite a bit of confusion on the additions to found in this NOPR as to what applies to gathering and what applies to transmission. And I recognize that there's headings and it's referenced throughout, but there seem to be some overlap. And I think that's where a lot of these questions are coming from. What is your plan as far as either further extension of comment period or I guess responding to some of these overlaps or miscommunications or misunderstandings where it comes to the point of what applies to transmission and what actually applies to the new regulated gathering portions, and then what on the flip side, what does not apply to we can call it unregulated gathering, but I still think we're required to have certain parts of that pipeline in one call and with line markers, so I'm not going to call it unregulated gathering, but the remaining gathering that's left on the table, and I'll hear your answer.
Well, right now we do not have a plan to extend the comment period. We're going to take this information that we received regarding the confusion. We're going to discuss it with our management and determine if any additional actions or clarifications need to be provided, and we'll try to get that information out as soon as possible. We'd be gladly to have additional conversations on that to make sure that everyone involved in this process is as clear on this proposal as possible.
Good deal. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll go to line of Heidi Keller. Please go ahead.
Hi. Yes. Thank you. I have two additional questions. During the rulemaking process, PHMSA conducted a number of integrity verification process workshops. And as a result, received several comments regarding IVP and transmission lines. The NPRM, however, only makes a passing reference to them, and we're wondering if PHMSA has any plans to address the industry IVP comments in the final rule.
Well, the comment period, you know, it's open to bring up some other questions that you may have seen, but our goal is to pick up all the comments we received, you know, on this NPRM as well as what we heard in workshops or in the advisory committee meeting, public meeting that we had last week, and these what we are hearing here. We'd like to address all of those issues in the final rule, yes.
Okay, thank you. And one more question. Does the NPRM accommodate operators who have tens of thousands of miles of gathering lines that have been constructed with non-metallic materials that are currently not approved in 49 CFR 192? And if it does accommodate operators, then where is that? Could you please tell us where that might be in the RIA?
Our regulations do not apply. Our statute does not allow us to apply construction-related standards to pipelines or new construction-related standards to pipelines that are already in the ground. So those pipelines that were constructed of those materials prior to the publication of this final rule will continue to be allowed.
Okay, thank you.
And next we'll go to line of Keith Meager. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Keith Meager with Northwestern Energy. We have a couple questions for you. In relation to the spike test, if you have a base pressure test that calls for 1.5 times the MAOP for 8 hours, is a spike test beyond this required?
It should not be. The 1.5 times would be adequate.
Okay. And then as far as piggable goes, is PHMSA going to define what constitutes a piggable line? And where we're coming at from that is you may have lines that are receptive to a ILI device, but flow rate or something else causes you not to be able to acquire usable data.
Well, it'd be helpful if you put that comment in the docket and we can add some definition. Otherwise, we always have FAQs that we introduce after the rulemaking to clarify further scenarios.
Okay. And then I've heard you talk a couple times about timeline, but we were wondering what PHMSA's expectation for this regulation process is to result in the final rule being published.
We do not have a date yet estimated. We're looking forward to receiving the comments. Reviewing the comments, identifying the issues that have been raised through those comments, and moving the rule as we're required by statute to our advisory committee. And after we get to that point, maybe we can start looking at or considering or estimating a date for a final rule.
Okay, thank you.
I think we have time for about one more question at this point.
Thank you, and we'll go to the line of Andrew Watson. Please go ahead.
Hello. In 192.607, the verification of pipeline materials, it states in there that you have 180 days to prepare your plan. Does it give a time frame in which that plan has to be executed like it does in the verification where there's a 15-year time frame?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'd have to have you read it. Let me look, and I'll tell you. Just quickly glancing through it, I do not see a time frame, but I may be missing it. But if it's not in here, any comments on suggestions of what we should put would be appreciated.
Steve, what about 192.607B?
B?
Yeah.
Well, let me go back. I may have I was glancing through it. I may have missed it.
It says each operator must prepare material documentation plan to implement all the actions required by this section by 6 months after the effective date of the rule.
Yes. But it, you could read that to say that you just have the plan within 180 days, not implemented. And I think that's his question.
Okay. Okay.
And we'll put an implementation. I think he's correct.
And with that question, that's going to conclude today's presentation, our webinar on the gas transmission NPRM. We want to thank our presenters, Mike Israni and Steve Nanny. We want to thank you, the public, for joining us today and giving us input and advice and guidance and comments on this rulemaking. And we're looking forward to seeing and reading your written comments, all of which are going to improve our product at the end of the day so that we can all move forward and improve pipeline safety throughout the country. I want to thank you again for participating and look forward to talking to you in the near future. Have a great day.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your conference for today. Thank you for using AT&T Executive Teleconference Service. You may now disconnect.